Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Okay, and welcome back to the Explaining History podcast, everybody. I am delighted to be joined today by Barbara Savage, who is the Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought at the University of Pennsylvania. Today we are talking about Mers Tate, an African-American scholar of diplomacy and international relations, who in an era of intense discrimination, racial and gender discrimination, managed to become one of the outstanding figures in her field, and whose work shaped the study of American diplomacy, but also American diplomacy itself in the 20th century. A fascinating figure, but also a way of shining a light on racial and gender politics and discrimination. So firstly, Barbara, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you for all of your good work spreading the word on history. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. So firstly, perhaps we can talk a bit about the work of researching Mers Tate and writing about her. What drew you to this? What brought you to this?
Well, I have had a vague familiarity with Tate's name just because I'm a scholar of 20th century African-American history. And so even people who are not well known will pop up in research. And the short story is that I was looking for something else. I was looking for materials on African-Americans who were serving as missionaries in the 20th century. And in the modern age, that means that when you go to begin that data search, you can put in, certain terms and things pop up. And so what popped up was Merce Tate's name, not because she had done work on African-American missionaries, because she had not, but because she had done work on American missionaries who had gone to Hawaii in the 1820s, beginning the long period of American presence there. And once I saw that, and she popped up in part because her work was in the Journal of Negro History, now the Journal of African American History, mm-hmm. which is one of the few places that Black scholars of her generation could get published, mm-hmm. regardless of the fact that her work actually had ostensibly very little to do with African American history. Her focus was someplace else. Mm-hmm. And once I found this article and began to read it, and it was really stellar scholarship, I then started to look for more of her work. And again, that was revealed to me, as you say, she was a really prolific diplomatic historian concerned about anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism, and US imperialism, but also an extraordinary biography. And so it really began because I was trying to answer the question, who is this woman? Because her biography revealed herself to be even more fascinating, or as fascinating as her work, in that she was a Black woman born into a family in rural Michigan in 1905, a fairly unusual place for black people at that time. Mm-hmm. And from there, she was able to imagine a life for herself, including an early ambition to become first a history teacher, which she did for many years, and then to become a scholar because she wanted to write and research. And so you see someone born in 1905, graduates from college in 1927, itself an unusual accomplishment for Black women. And then through a whole interesting twist and turns, ends up at Oxford in the 1930s, 1932 to 1935. And from there, she earns a graduate degree in international relations. Again, an unusual accomplishment for a woman at that time. There were very few women at Oxford in that period. And certainly she was, in fact, the only Black American woman there during the time she was there. And from that, she comes back to the United States and begins teaching, but then gets a doctorate in government from Harvard in 1941, then joins the faculty at Howard in 1942, where she spends the rest of her academic career. Now, I say that by way of responding, I guess, to your opening about how unusual that all of that was during the period of Jim Crow, segregation and discrimination, both on the basis of race and sex. And so that's what drew me to her, was both the unusual biography and the extraordinary work. And I'm happy to say more about both of those.
How do we explain this? I mean, is it simply that, within every structure of discrimination, there are outliers, flukes, accidents? Or was there a sort of like a means by which she was able to move forward in life?
It's a combination of the strength and power of her own mind. She was a brilliant woman, and also coupled with that, sometimes brilliant people are not also very hardworking, principled, bold and audacious in terms of her sense of self, and really someone who by nature and temperament was not going to take no for an answer. Mm-hmm. So she was able to move into these spaces and into her career in part because of the strength of her own personality and character and temperament, but she always credited her success, and I think she's correct in this, to the generosity and support of older women, Black women, older white women, who at every stage of her career helped make possible the move into the next position, particularly as it comes to her training and education. And that was true in how she got to Oxford. She got to Oxford on a scholarship from her Black women's sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, who had established an international study fellowship for their members, and she took advantage of that. And she was able to get to Harvard through the generosity of a woman dean there who saw her potential and helped make a way for her. And I should say also that the women at Oxford, though they were small in number, also took her in and supported her during the 3 years she was there. So there's that. She also would credit something she calls providence, which in less in religious terms is a kind of serendipity quality. One thing opens, when things keep opening for her, and she is definitely someone who takes advantage of every opportunity, pounces on it, pursues opportunities, and is very aggressive in that way. So It's that interesting combination of person, assistance, she would say, providence, and also just the strength of her own drive.
And what would you say, I mean, what were her, for want of a better word, what were her politics?
Well, her politics are it's a really great question, because I struggle with it. And in the end, I resisted labeling her because I felt like the labels really would not only, were too narrow for someone of her generation and also of her inclinations. So here we have someone who's strongly anti-imperialist, strongly anti-colonial, who had seen the remnants of that system face to face during a year she spent in India on a Fulbright and through her many travels all around the world. And so in ordinary times, you would call her a radical. Mm-hmm. But I don't apply that term to her, because I think that, at least in this country, that term implies, you know, a certain kind of embrace of Marxism, which she was very familiar with and which she taught and understood, but which she never claimed personally. And you also find that in her generation of scholars, this is someone, as I said, born in 1905. She does live till 1996. That's a whole nother challenge, trying to write about someone who lives the full century practically. But I would see her then as a woman. She's trying to figure out what an educated modern womanhood will look like. What do you do with women like her in the 1930s who've made a decision? You know, at some point she remains unmarried and without children. And so she starts to write, her earliest writings really are about that. How do you educate women who have this opportunity to basically fulfill roles traditionally expected of them, but who also could move outside of the home into professions? And how do you also then train those women to help uplift the race? This is an American term, but to help actually be engaged in work. And so I would say that on all of the political issues, she was, you know, a strong supporter of the NAACP, you know, did lots of work, community-based work in Washington and elsewhere. And so she was in the mainstream of progressive Black politics during her life. Mm-hmm. But when you live from 1905 to 1996, you know, there are periods when you are in your own time politically. There are periods when you're way ahead of your time, and her work consistently is way ahead of its time in terms of its analysis. But then towards the end of your life, I would say in the last quarter century of your life, you know, the world moves a little bit beyond where you are. And I think that's one of the challenges in one of writing about someone with such a long life. So I have resisted labeling her. And as I'm doing that, and my answer is reflecting that. But I don't find her that much of an outlier from other educated Black people of her generation and of her training.
So, I mean, for example, I have a month or two ago, I spoke with Chad Williams on the life of W.E.B. Du Bois. And I wonder if there were any connections between them. They existed in sort of a similar sorts of time periods. And again, he's an individual who is very sort of mercurial over time. You know, his politics evolve. And probably, I mean, that's probably fair to say about most people in some regard. The answer is often it depends when you get them. And she lives through, obviously, she is a scholar in the 1930s. She returns to America in the 1940s. She lives through the experience of the Second World War. And she's somebody who's a scholar of diplomacy and international relations. How did the Second World War shape her? I mean, what sense did she make of that?
All right. So you've asked like 20 different questions. You know that, don't you? Yeah. I'll start with the first one on Du Bois and her and their relationship. And then I'll be very happy to talk about World War II, because it's actually it's a really great question. And it's actually a definitive period for her personally and in her work. She knew Du Bois. Du Bois knew her. And he actually reviewed her first published work in the 1940s. This is a book that she wrote on disarmament and the arms race, in which she makes an argument about imperialism and that the people are gathering armaments and navies, not for self-defense, as everybody is saying, but because they need to be able to control and police and acquire colonies, which is a really inventive, it's certainly way ahead of the traditional diplomatic history field, international relations at that time. So Du Bois reviews her book, gives it a very good review, essentially in the end chides her a little bit for not being as radical as he is, but not in a way that's disrespectful. At other periods in her life, she interacts with him at conferences, at Howard. She defends him when people begin to attack him as being, believe it or not, being old and senile. And she defends him and says, I saw him last week. He's as capable as he's ever been. And so she was a great admirer of Du Bois. How could she not be? I think one of the things that I have tried to do in this book is to, especially for scholars of African-American history, is to think about our fields in ways. I'm not trying to decenter Du Bois so much as to expand the panoply of folks that we look at when we think about great minds of the 20th century. Yeah. And in some ways there's some overlap in their work, but she actually has a very different set of interests. But it's interesting that you raised World War II, because part of what I argue in this book about her is that she actually is a child of World War I.
Right.
And that actually shapes her in one way. And World War II, I think, shapes her in another way, but in ways that are really consistent. And so in World War I, she comes of age at a time when she's able to read newspapers and to see what's happening with African-Americans here, at a time when Black soldiers are fighting on behalf of this country, but suffering through segregation and discrimination, fighting the segregated armed forces. She had an older brother who served in the Navy and came back home with tales of World War I. And so even as a 16-year-old girl in an oratorical contest, she raises all of those issues about the inequalities that that still exist for people who are also serving and fighting and defending this country and who are being patriots. Mm-hmm. So that theme then is just redoubled when World War II comes. And by then, as I said, she's written about disarmament, but she also writes writes compellingly about coupling both World War and World War I and World War II, about the shame of racism and racial inequality in this country, as yet again, we call on Black soldiers to go and serve and fight. And, World War II is a period, I think, of intense radicalization for many African-Americans, including those who serve and come back home because of the opportunity to travel and see and to also form communities of Black people outside of the communities where folks grew up. So both world wars, one and two, really shaped her politically, and not just on the domestic front of what's happening with African Americans here, but she sees both of those wars as part of a longer battle around anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism.
And that kind of brings me to my next point. So if you look at the 25 years after the Second World War, mm-hmm. this is the kind of colonialism sunset in a way, or one kind of colonialism sunset. You see British, French, Belgian colonialism across Africa, Asia, and the Middle East go into rapid retreat. So where was she in all of that, in terms of her ideas and what she had to say about it?
Well, by the 1970s, she, so much has happened, of course, as she's lived through the civil rights movement, she's lived through desegregation, even though her eyes are on the world at large. And so once we get through the period of Black Power, which affects and student protests at Howard around issues of race and inequality, she has shifted by then towards a sort of a final project that she's doing on Africa, having written about the Pacific, which is the bulk of the largest corpus of her work is actually about American imperialism in the Pacific, primarily through Hawaii. But by the 1970s, she shifted to Africa. And even in this age of decolonization or of empires falling or being renamed or recalled, or she is really concerned about what she calls corporate imperialism. That is the power of international corporations in Africa. And very specifically, she's interested in railroads and deep seaports and mineral extraction and the ways that the colonial railways in Africa, first built in Egypt, actually, but then, throughout the continent, are as she says, they become as powerful as armaments, as tools of imperialism. Yeah. And so she's trying to trace not only the early colonial railways, but all the new railways that are built in the 1970s and the deep sea ports, particularly in southern and eastern Africa, that she sees as a real threat to the future of an independent Africa, and really begins to envision what we then see, so clearly in the centuries that follow. And so that's what she's working on at the end of her life. She sees railways as she calls them, the sinews and arteries of empire. That's the name of one of the projects that she's working on. And it's a really interesting project, which she was not able to bring to print, but I've been able to cobble together arguments and her approach to it.
Yeah.
And she had originally envisioned it as a trans-imperial project. That is, that she would not just look at British railways, but although the British are particularly good at it, as you may know, but at other, at American corporations who are right there, as well. And so that brings together her interest in both travel and in Africa. But she's also always been kind of mechanically inclined or very comfortable with engineering and all of that, and very detail oriented, and was able to gather a tremendous amount of material from the corporations themselves, unsuspecting for them, to produce this work. So in that way, she's actually looking ahead into post-independent Africa.
And she almost seems to have the mind almost of the investigative journalist there.
She does, and it's coupled with she's an archive hound. She's someone who is both very comfortable with detail to an excessive amount. At some point, I say that as someone who had to read everything she wrote, but it's in she believes that the story is actually in the details, and that if you're going to understand what's really happening in that moment, you need to understand Alcoa, and you need to understand other aluminum manufacturers and the connections, particularly that she sees between those corporations and the continued exploitation of indigenous Black labor in Africa.
Would she have had a particular interest in, say, Congo?
It's interesting that you should say that. Most of her focus actually is on South Africa and the ports along that side. But she does write about the Congo in a research paper, and she used it to show the involvement of American industrialists and entrepreneurs in the Congo in that period. And that was a standalone work that she delivered at a conference. Actually, a couple. I think that was on iron ore, if I'm not correct. It's tied to a particular industry, but that's what she uses that to say, we can't just blame the Belgians. We're there too.
Yeah. So in that time, I mean, when she was sort of drawing these connections as kind of official kind of empires withdraw, and you get these sort of rather more opaque, invisible empires of economic extraction. And I don't really kind of call them trade, because that's a rather sort of rather misnomer. That's a bit of a euphemism. But this kind of neo-colonialism. Were there many people in the field at the time making these sorts of points, or is she kind of the trailblazer?
She's a trailblazer, and it gets picked up much later and gets to be called, and it's renamed something else. But that work, when she's doing it, no one is really looking at it in that way. And I think this is actually true of all of her work, is that the field catches up with her down the road, but she's there early. Certainly in diplomatic history and international relations in the U.S., the field turns towards something that looks more like a critique of imperialism, but really much later in the mid to late 1970s, I would say, or even beyond that. And so she's already there. And she's old. She lives long enough to begin to write reviews about that younger generation. And she congratulates them and chides them in a backhanded way to basically say, you know, welcome to my world. Yes, this is what we need to be thinking about.
And I think those ideas become mainstream. I mean, it's pretty much received wisdom now, but those ideas become mainstream probably as late as the 1990s, when you're talking about, and you know, the beginnings of anti-globalization movements and that kind of thing. This is where they become almost, you know, popularized.
Well, when we move into the use of the term globalization to mean all sorts of things, I think that you're right, that I would pin it to the later period. But I do think, at least in this country, there's a great deal, especially in African-American politics and among African-American progressive thinkers and organizers. Remember, the Free South Africa movement erupts.
Yes.
Well, it doesn't really erupt. It's there. It's even there in this period, but it really moves into a different gear, if you will, in the 1980s, where it's a much more. But the identification of African Americans with the plight of workers and people and what was then Rhodesia and then South Africa and elsewhere is particularly strong and actually is present throughout the century. But so I would also say that in the fields of diplomatic history, international relations, attention to race and therefore and or to Africa and what you call sort of neocolonialism, it comes later. The field of African American history is there from its genesis, so to speak. So it's, you're right about it being mainstream, but let's not forget that there is actually a very virulent minority that's been saying that for 100 years.
Yeah, and I suppose that, I mean, in the Black Power era of the civil rights movement, you have people like Stokely Carmichael saying, you know, there is a connection between how Southern Black people are treated and the way that people in Africans are treated. These things aren't a coincidence, and they are part of a wider struggle for emancipation. And they're making those sorts of observations.
Yeah, it's an interesting period, because it's funny that you mentioned Carmichael, because he was a student at Howard and actually was part of the not, and it was from Howard that he went, you know, south with to do organizing there. But there had been these student protests at Howard, wanting the curriculum to be reorganized to have more teaching about Africa and imperialism. And though she disagreed with the tactics, because that kind of protest is, if you're a teacher and if you're on faculty, it's disruptive, you know, students can't get to class, all that. She's thinking as a teacher, but in fact, she literally says, if you can't beat them, you might as well join them. And so she begins to offer a new course on imperialism in Africa to those students and uses it as a place for them to come and learn and talk and basically to be able to finesse their own understandings of what's happening there. And so that's an example of her basically moving along with the times, but in some ways she would also say that the times, you know, caught up with her too, mm-hmm. because she had been actually writing about Africa and imperialism for a long time.
Right. And, so in the final years of her life, when did she retire from academia?
She retires in 1977, but lives until 1996. And so in that 20-year period after she retires, that's when she is still working on the project on Africa. But she's also working at that time, and this does get published, on imperialism, as I said, in the Pacific. But she actually begins to look at the way at the inclinations of Australia and New Zealand vis-a-vis their smaller, more vulnerable neighbor islands, and really writes about a wide variety of ideas and tensions in the Southwest Pacific. She writes about the U.S. Detonating atomic and doing atomic weapon testing in that region, which is often overlooked. Mm-hmm. But she is she's very committed to highlighting the presence and the continued exploitation of Indigenous people in that region as well. So she's juggling both the work on the remaining work on the Southwest Pacific and then this work on Africa.
And, you know, as far as the kind of, to use a very, very broad term, the establishment view her, Was she a kind of a dissident academic, or does she have any influence in things like the State Department, or was she largely ignored?
She sought and would have liked to have been treated as the expert she was, particularly on disarmament, by the State Department. And there were attempts by her and others to have her become involved in some of the work that was happening there. That did not happen, but she was involved in UNESCO, mm-hmm. and UNESCO projects in the late 1948, you know, after the UN's formation. And for them, she writes about, she writes about atomic, the particular dangers in the post-World War II world of atomic weapons, and particularly after the United States deployed them. And that is what she brings to, you know, to that discussion. But if you look at the careers of other African-American intellectuals who were trained in similar ways, and the one who comes to mind would be Ralph Bunche, of course, who is then drawn into, you know, first OSS and then becomes a part of UN efforts. Those opportunities did not come her way. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I can't judge that. But I think at the time she would have welcomed it, though she was such a bold thinker. It's difficult for me to imagine her following any company line, even the company line is that of the United States. She's such an independent thinker and not someone who took to being told or prescribed. And so I think in the long run, it was that worked out all right for her.
Well, every great careerist needs to know how to play the game, don't they? You know.
Well, I wouldn't so much say she was. Yes. Yes, you're talking about Bunch, I hope.
Not about her, no.
Yeah, thank you. No.
Well, there we must draw to a close, but It's been a delight to talk today, and there's so much more to, I think, to discuss around all of the multiplicity of things that have come up today. So I do hope you'll pop back in the future, and perhaps we can
I'd be delighted to. Yeah, we can. I'll be happy. And as you know, as ideas come up. But thank you so much. And this, you know, the book, you know, Merce Tate, The Global Odyssey of a Black Woman Scholar, comes out here next week. It comes out in the UK in February.
Wow. Okay. So my annual, my not annual, but my regular kind of shout out to everyone. This is obviously a great addition to any bookshelf. Do, if you're going to purchase it, try to support your independent book retailer, because they are part of a whole ecosystem of knowledge that, once it has been crushed by Amazon, won't be coming back. So let's support those guys, please, please do. Fantastic. So Barbara, it's been a real pleasure, and we'll finish there. And okay. Good luck with the book, and I hope to chat again.
Yes, I look forward to it. And thank you so much again for all the good work that you're doing and reaching people in this way and making a really productive use of this media form. Not always the case.
Of course.
So, thank you.
All the best.